Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Hello and welcome to Mentor Dialogue, episode number 235. Today is the 28th of May, 2017, and this interview is with Giles English, who's co-founder of the leading luxury British watchmaker, Bremont, with a mission to bring back luxury watchmaking to Britain, and a strong desire to follow his passion. Giles and his brother Nick founded Bremont in 2002. In this chat, Giles shares with us his strategic approach, the way he has built and differentiated his Bremont brand, as well as the marvelous stories that surround the company and each watch, a true lesson in brand building. Welcome to the Mentor Dialogue Internet Show, where we discuss brand marketing with a focus on all things digital. I am Mentor Dial, author of TheMindset.com, that's T-H-E-M-Y-N-D-S-E-T, where branding gets personal. You'll find the show notes on the blog for the upcoming interview. Let's cut to the quick. Enjoy the show. Hello, and welcome to the Mentor Dialogue. Giles English, great to have you on the show. Thanks for joining.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Giles, I heard really about your story for the first time at a wonderful Like Minds event in the heart of London. And, of course, having the last name English certainly could be an indication of what we're about to speak about. But we're going to be speaking about Bremont, which is this divine luxury watch company that you founded. And unlike most luxury watch companies that usually sort of luxury watch companies that start with, you know, since 1843. You guys are since 2002. So if you could, tell us who you are, what you do, and what's your mindset, Giles, this fine morning?
Yes. Hello. We're one of the few British watch companies. There aren't many around. And it really started out of a passion project. My father was this amazing engineer, and he loved his watches and clocks and grew up around him, and he died in a plane crash in 1995, and at the time we were all pilots, but I trained as an engineer, and my brother was with the plane crash, and he survived, and really that triggered for us was this desire to go and carry on this sort of family love of building watches and really build on this wonderful history of British watchmaking that not many people know about. So that's really where it all started, and it feels like not that long since 2002, but it's been a lot of hard work since that.
How about your mindset? How do you describe your mindset, Giles?
My mindset. My mindset is rather positive, actually. I think when you're running a business and you're doing quite a lot of stuff around the world, you don't really have a chance to ever sit back and relax. So I think you have to get up and try and hit the world each morning, which saps your energy, but it's rather exciting.
So when I listen to you, Giles, apart from the continuing the tradition, I should say, or at least in the wake of your father, engineering adventurer, pilot, you also have this desire to reignite English watchmaking. So tell us a little bit more about that. For the most people who are listening probably don't know much about the history of English watchmaking and why your mission is so particularly interesting.
Yeah, it is fascinating. Everyone thinks Swiss made for high-end mechanical watches. at the turn of the century, we were making half the world's watches in the UK. We, you know, the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time, not Geneva Mean Time. There were so many great inventions that came from the since sort of 1760 when Harrison invented the marine chronometer. We were leading the world. We were very slow to industrialize. Two world wars knocked all our skills set out. We were too busy making guns, planes, and supporting the war effort. Switzerland as a neutral country really took over the mantle, and the British and German watch industries slowly died out. And so we were very aware of this wonderful history growing up in our works with our father. And there are over 750 Swiss watch companies. We felt that if we could build a beautiful product in the UK, although we were only going to have a very, very small percentage of that market, we still felt it was a big market. And slightly madly, we went on this long journey.
So you've gone up against the monumental Swiss competitor, but you're also presumably feeling like you're going up against iPhones and Apple Watches.
Well, that's a fascinating one. Obviously, when we started, there wasn't such things as the smartwatch. And, you know, from nowhere, Apple is something that, you know, in the top few largest watch manufacturers now, which is quite amazing. I think, you know, the wonderful thing about a mechanical watch is you buy one of our watches, it's all cogs and gears. There's 86,400 seconds in a day, and these cogs and gears will be within some 3 or 4 seconds accuracy. And that watch will work in 200 years' time. Yes, you'll have to service it, but there'll be watchmakers still be able to fix that in 200 years' time. So there's very few things you can buy nowadays that last forever. You know, you're going to buy a new car now, in 3 years' time, it's worthless. And that's the beauty of what we buy. Yes, you can tell your time on your phone or your computer or anything else, but having a luxury watch on your wrist is really a good long-term investment, but something which is beautiful and very practical as well.
So do you think, Charles, you are in this, and I don't mean to be facetious, tapping into an old folks' thought, or is there some deeper context that even amongst the younger, the idea of the ephemeral nature of our world, the sort of, you know, the quick Snapchats and all that, are we actually, are you possibly looking to return us to some good old values?
Oh, I think there is a strong element of that. I mean, but I think it's the same with jewelry. Why do young people wear jewelry, you know, precious thing, when you can get some manufactured diamond instead, far cheaper? It's that worth. It's we're selling luxury. But I also think if something like smartwatches gets people to wear watches, then they're used to wearing something on the wrist, and then there is a progression to something like your luxury watch. So it can be beneficial to the market. I think where the luxury watch market, the watch market has been really hit by the smartwatch, is in the cheaper fashion segment, which kids are going from their fashion watches and buying a smartwatch instead. But is it harking back to old age history, or is it a beautiful, made mechanical device that you can wear every day you really appreciate? So it's I think probably a bit of both.
Well, one thing is for sure. I'm an Apple fan and I like their watch, and the idea that you can personalize it is sort of the defining element of the Apple Watch for me. Whereas with your watches, you guys are all about the story behind the watch. And what I'd like if you could is just share with us, the initialization and the use of the word Bremont, which certainly isn't very British. And then I want to get into this notion of how you construct your watches, because I find it absolutely delicious. So tell us about the Bremont beginning.
Yes, when we started out, Nick and I, we went over to Switzerland for a number of years, is over 5 years before we sold our first watch. And what most brands do in the watch space, out of all of those watch brands around, you know, very few were companies that have been trading since 1722 or whenever it was.
Right.
They're resurrected brands, and they were, you know, took their branding and redid it. Nick and I felt if we did that, if I could have got Harrison or Mudge or Tompion, one of the great British watchmakers, and we could have relaunched them and said we'd been trading since, you know, all those years. But we felt, one, you'd be living a bit of a lie, but also how as a brand could we work with a Boeing or a Jaguar or a Martin Baker, and to that actually make sense for a brand known for making historical marine chronometers in 1760. So that was our mindset there. We then we couldn't use our surname. My surname's English. You would never get the trademark of English on a watch. So really the name came from experience. About 3 years after Dad died, Nick and I were flying in an old biplane through France, and we got caught in some terrible weather. And in the UK, when that happens, you put it down a field and you give the farmer a bottle of whiskey and say sorry. But in France, if you land in an unlicensed airfield, they can impound your aircraft, make you take your wings off. It's a complete disaster.
A little bit of French bureaucracy.
Yeah, well, exactly. There's no shortage of that. So we got stuck in this terrible weather, running out of fuel. We had to put it down in a French farmer's pea field. And we landed thinking it was going to be a disaster. And this lovely old man came out and helped us out. And we stayed with him a couple of days. And he was in his 80s and was restoring his old tractors. And he was just a real character. And Nick and I thought, if our father had reached his 80s, he would have been this man. And we left. And this chap was called Antoine Bremont. And we thought, Bremont, that's a nice sounding name, and we get the trademark and look good on a watch. Let's use that, and that's literally just where it came from. And he just thought we're crazy Englishmen, and off we went. So that's the story behind the name. Not particularly British sounding.
No,
I agree,
but it does have its authenticity. So first of all, I understood that Bremont was actually wearing his father's watch.
He liked his clocks and his watches, and he was an old pilot himself. So he was just a character that we connected with.
Unbelievably similar in some ways. And then did he ever get to know, I assume he's passed away since, so did he get to know that you named the company after him?
Yeah, so we told him what we were going to do. This was very early days, and he just thought we're crazy Englishmen. And sadly, he died not that long after. So we never got to know him very well. But it was an amusing encounter.
Yeah, but it's glorious. And so the other thing, Joss, I mean, you're in this world competing with so many other established, installed, you know, big name brands and big budgets. You have this particular approach with each of your watches. And so give us some, maybe what's your favorite watch to talk about?
Yeah, I think, you know, ultimately, branding aside, if you can make a, you know, when we set out, you have to make a product that when the most hardcore watch journalist came across you, he would pick up your watch and say, no, I've never heard of the brand before. What's this about British watchmaking? But actually, this is a really nice watch for the price point. And we knew if we got that tick in the box, it would help. And so we have our core collection. Our whole remit was about, you know, our aviation background, and about 20% of our business just making for military now. But it was about a classic style watch you could wear in the boardroom up or up Mount Everest. And so we had special hardening treatments, all that sort of stuff. Technically, it's just wonderful. But every few years, we come up with interesting limited editions. And really, we slightly stumbled on this, that there's this watch we created back in about 2007-8 called EP120. And we're with an old family friend of my father's who owns the largest collection of historical aircraft in Europe. And he's restoring this beautiful old Spitfire, which has, you know, huge history. He'd taken an aluminium panel off the wing, and we're with him, and he said, he's holding this panel and said, do you realize this is flying by a 19-year-old kid over Dresden in 1942. What a piece of history. And Nick and I looked in the Spitfire and it had this beautiful old British Smith's clock in it. And he thought, actually, why don't we build a watch based on that beautiful clock, but use that metal of that Spitfire in the back of the watch? And it's a real commemoration to the Spitfire, to the pilots, everything else. And we did, and this watch just sold instantly. And if you can buy one of those today, they sell for about 4 or 5 times the original value. And it really triggered this sort of limited edition thing we come out with every few years. So the last watch we did, recently was one called the Wright Flyer that we did with parts of the Wright Flyer Wilbur and Orville's aircraft built into the back of the watch, using Orville's pocket watch, raising a lot of money for charity to restore Wilbur and Orville's family home in Dayton, Ohio. So these, mechanically, they're beautiful, but also they have these wonderful stories, history, and charitable elements, and it's become a bit of a hallmark of the brand. But it's something just on a personal level, Nick and I do all the design, and it's something we get very, very integrated within, and it's something to be part of. So that's, yeah, keep an eye out for interesting things we come out with there. It's always quite fun.
I must imagine there's a lot of enjoyment of the research, the detail orientation, and then you're crafting it around your own passions, which includes flying.
Lovely thing of having your own business, and when you do all the design, is you are basing it on what you personally like. And I think where I see where brands go wrong is that they design by committee, they market by committee. So you just come bland and you try and appeal to everyone.
Yeah,
I don't think in life you can make everyone like you, and you just learn to live like that. But hopefully there's enough people who like what you like. And I think that sort of drives us.
What's the hardest part of your job, Giles?
The hardest part is the diversity of what we do. I mean, ultimately, we are an engineering company. Manufacturing, I have 80, 90 people in Hennion Thames building watches. All of those are trained up. We put apprenticeship schemes in place. You're trying to train watchmakers, polishers, machinists, designers. So ultimately, we're an engineering company making something very complicated. But you also have to be very good at marketing. People don't buy a watch for our price point unless they've heard the brand, they've read about it, they've seen it on social media and the magazines, etc., etc. So you have to be very good at marketing, and you have to do it globally. So you can't be a watch brand and just be in one country, because so much of the watch buyers around the world are global travelers, and they expect to see you everywhere.
Luxury watches, anyway.
Luxury watches, yes. Yeah. And we own our own shops, so you have to be good at retail as well. So ultimately, it's just a very complicated business. So when you wake up in the morning each day, is it about the specking the new CNC machine you want to buy to machine watch components, or is it doing a press interview? So it's a complicated business. Mm.
I want to get into that in a moment, but I did have one last question about the product per se, which is that as you're trying to establish a point of difference, you have your brand, your stories, the link with you, your family, and so on. But you also offer a 3-year warranty. And so my question is, why a 3-year warranty? Most brands don't do as long, but why stop at 3? It's sort of at a certain level, it's almost like you are building the definitive adventurer's watch. I saw on a tweet yesterday or something that someone said, well, I'm going to do a really rough ride on my bicycle, my motorcycle. Should I take it off? Because otherwise it's going to jiggle it around too much. And you said, or someone said, hell no, that's what it's made for. And I thought that was a brilliant response.
Might live to regret that one.
Yeah, right.
I think the mechanical watches are inherently quite delicate. There's no doubt about that. Cause it's cogs and gears. You knock it around, and you still have to protect it. But we wanted a mechanical watch which wasn't just going to be used with your suit and your board meeting, but actually to be properly used and enjoyed. And that's where that the DNA came from. And 3-year warranty and why not longer is because watch needs to be serviced. So that's sort of beyond there, really, you should consider servicing a watch, you know, four or five years, because you've got hundreds of moving components that need to be oiled, and that oil, it's a bit like driving your car, you need to get changed oil. The same happens with a watch. We really do stand by our products, and that's key to people's reassurance and why, when they're buying one of our watches. But also, we're not making that many compared with the big boys. Yeah. So you're getting something very exclusive as well.
And when you reservice a watch, because I have my own luxury watch, but when you reservice it, will you re-extend the guarantee?
Yes, exactly. So you get an extended guarantee after that service.
That's brilliant. All right, so I want to talk about your marketing and the selection and how you go about selling it, you know, getting out there. As you say, you're up against the big boys, big budgets, and you've got to be global. So what would be the areas in marketing where you say there's the biggest bang for your quid as opposed to a buck?
Yeah, for your buck or quid. Ultimately, what built Bremont, this was, you know, we were days before social media, was PR, getting people to write about you, having stories like your EP120 watch, the story of what you're doing as a brand, and making those journalists truly believe in what you're trying to do. So that, without doubt, has been the most powerful in conventional press doing that. Then I think also, you know, as a young brand, we've never had the advertising to go and, you know, put it in the magazines and put it, you know, ads everywhere. But we always had a lot of content. So the stuff Nick and I do, the people we meet, these amazing sort of ambassadors who are doing interesting stuff. And so we've always had a lot of content as a brand to talk about. So when social media started taking off, and blogs were becoming more interactive, actually, as a brand, we weren't just saying, this is a watch. We were going to more detail. This is how you make the watch. This is the people wearing the watches, doing interesting stuff. These are the partners we work with. So, and it was all, none of it was marketing made up stuff. This was sort of just evolution as a brand. So I think that's really helped us grow. And with modern brands, you can't be a faceless brand anymore. Whereas the big boys could easily be that, you have to be far more personal. And I think in the modern day, we fitted into that role. And it's very genuine to how we want to live our brand. So I think that's helped.
You know, something that you and I shared when we met was this notion that actually, I mean, as much as the product itself is glorious and a fine piece of work, it's more the stories around the object that, and history of the object and the people who are wearing it, which are the stories to tell.
Yeah, I think, but the general public see through if it's a story. Yeah, if you make it up, that, you know, I've learned this in marketing over the years, is that these little nuances, these subtle points, the general public pick it up far quicker than you ever think they would. So, you know, to say you're an aviation watch and just have, you know, pretty models standing in front of glam planes is just not going to work these days. We can say that we're an aviation watch because, you know, Nick and I were both in the RAF. My father was. We grew up, we both fly. 20-25% of our business is just making for the military. So if you're a U-2 spy plane pilot or F-18 pilot flying for Carrier, you're wearing our watches. So none of that is made up. It's just what we are. And I think brands, you have to, in this modern world, really preach what you believe and that to be part of you, because everyone sees through it if you don't.
Well, I completely agree. And I didn't mean to say stories as in fibs.
I wasn't implying you were.
No, of course. But as, you know, these big boys, what they end up doing is sort of trying to fabricate those stories. And they're not as willing to say, I mean, unless it's a celebrity, in which case they have to probably pay them. But the feeling of more rugged stories around your adventures and the people who are wearing, and there's definitely a feeling of legitimacy and authenticity in the stories that you wind around each of your watches.
Yeah, and I think with, you know, brands do well in this modern world, it has to be authentic. I totally agree with you there.
So the other thing which really struck me was this notion of distribution and the desire to have your own stores. So if you know, in one regard, I think of Apple, who have had an obsession with controlling the entire chain. Of course, that they don't make the components in the beginning, but they are very much involved and want to have total control along the channel, for including their own stores. Tell us a little bit about your distribution strategy and to what extent you really do want and own your own stores.
I think owning your own stores is very expensive and can be quite a high risk way to go. So our strategy is not to only go through our own distribution, our own stores around the world. But our strategy has been very much to own our own distribution. So that is, when I go into America, we don't go through a distributor, which is the standard way. You'd normally go through a distributor. He guarantees he'll buy X number of watches per year off you, and he does all the marketing, do everything else. We thought that was one remove from what we're trying to do, and we need to be more personal with those retailers and manage that process ourselves. So it's always going to be a slower growth, but it meant we're making full margin and we were controlling our message in America, Asia, wherever else we go. And if a market's going badly, you don't have a distributor out there who's sitting on 1,000 watches saying, buy them back or else I'm going to dump them cheap on the internet, which is what distributors can do. So that was very important for us. And then we launched a store in the UK and we realized that actually it helped your whole wholesale distribution because people can come in, feel the brand, and they may go and buy it from their local retailer. So it's not just about sales. It's very much a marketing entry into the world of Bremel. And that became a very strong thing for us. So we have four stores around the world. We'll probably open another couple, but it's not a massive thing for us because it's very expensive to do. But it's very powerful marketing. And I think if people can read about it. And if they go into Selfridges, they see us in there in a little counter, but they can't really buy into the whole brand. Whereas they go into our store, they very quickly understand what we're all about.
In amongst the challenges that I see in a number of luxury brands is this notion of the global customer. So they go into a store in Tokyo, they might, let's say, and they see your beautiful watch in a Takashima department store or, you know, whatever retailer you decided. They buy that and then they travel to Rio or London, you know, and they, it doesn't work, something's broken, and they go to the local store where they see Bremont being sold and they say, listen, I need to fix this. But it's a different retailer. It's not obviously Takashimaya or whomever, you know, you might have had. How do you manage that process?
Well, that process should be seamless if that retailer is a good retailer. But if it's a bad retailer and you haven't trained them well enough, or then that customer won't feel the love. The trick is picking the right retailer. So as a customer, you can go into one of our stores or one of our jewelers, and they'll give you the same level of love and say, don't worry, sir, we'll get that sorted. We'll send it straight back to Bremel, call us up, blah, blah, blah. But also, I think with the internet, with live chat on your website, you can help that process seem more seamless as well. But it's incredibly important. And as you get bigger, it's harder to control. And you need more and more training to be able to enable that a level of customer service.
Well, the area where this becomes tricky is I purchased a pre-owned Bremel. I bought it on eBay and I go into the store. So what I wanted to get into was the idea of the single customer view. And to what extent do you have a database that allows you to know the authentic owner of each of these watches?
Yeah, so we have a CRM database which should list most of the watches that have been purchased as long as they've been registered. So we know who originally bought that watch, where it was sold from. We encourage second-hand market on it, so if people buy it second-hand, we don't see them as a prior. We love the fact that guy's bought a Bremont. He can come in. He'll very much enter as part of the Bremont family. As long as that watch hasn't been stolen or there's anything dodgy about that. But we can track that history. So if you're looking to buy a watch online, and you can call us up and we can confirm that watch hasn't been registered as a stolen watch or anything like that.
And what's your general policy with regard to all these people who are obviously rather affluent and these clients? So you have the database. To what extent do you try to animate or communicate take advantage of your link with them?
Well, to me, the future of marketing is about databases. It's about having that direct connection with your clients, even though he may not have bought that watch off you. It's about infusing him. It's about keeping him abreast of the brand. And anyone trying to grow a business who isn't doing that is making life very hard for himself. It's far cheaper to communicate to someone on your database than trying to get to him through adverts. It's very important.
Yeah, much less trying to acquire a new one.
Yeah, but you got to have the system to get that client's data and then be able to provide him the right level of content without annoying him, without putting him off. So it's a fine line, but incredibly powerful if you get it right.
Yeah, and the other element to that, for having run a company that had, it was in 40 countries with distributors in the middle at times, the issue is sometimes getting to have the retailer to give you the information. I mean, at least, you know, they might say, well, you're going to be, you know, taking my customer or, you know, co-opting my customer that I managed to get off the streets in Tokyo.
Then if you won't give us the information, we can't deliver that level of customer service. We can't give a warranty on that watch, so they shouldn't be a retailer of ours.
It's as simple as that. Yeah, it comes back to your choice of, if you go through distribution, they're not going to be as attentive to that kind of a detail.
No, and if you go through distribution, you don't know which retail they're putting your watches in. A distributor's remit is just to sell and make money. Our remit is to sell, yes, but with the right customers, with the right long-term gain. Short-term gains can be very different to long-term gains. And that's, you know, we're building a global luxury brand that we want to be here in 100 years' time. It's a very different view.
Beautiful segue to my last question, Giles. So I'm not going to talk about next steps, next quarter, next year even, but the long-term vision, because let's say you're 100 years' time. The challenge is you, the founders, your energy, you and Nick, and you're driving it. You got that passion for detail. You are the authentic aviators. Does the CEO in 100 years' time have to be an aviator, nuts about watchmaking, design himself or herself, and have a father who was a tinkerer and a pilot?
Well, ideally, yes. But no, I think, if you look at other brands, you know, they carry on in the same form as Chanel or Louis Vuitton, and it's less focused on the founders, but the ethos is very similar. And I think good, you know, companies, their marketing teams live and breathe that brand. They every message, every statement they put out is on brand. And when that starts jumping all over the place, that's when you have issues. And that's the real challenge, is anyone who comes on in the business, can they really be on brand? And I think that's incredibly important, because as soon as you start getting a bit wishy-washy and jumping around with different messaging, it gets very challenging. And that's also a challenge for us, as you know, Nick and I still very much heading it all up, is you can make the wrong calls. You can over-push partnerships that confuse your message. So we as founders and active people running the business still get it wrong as well. So that is confusing, especially as you grow, your message can change. So it's it's never easy, that's for sure.
Mm. So Giles, my father was a pilot, and so I've flown many, many hours in what was a Cessna 310 turbo. And the question I had was a last sort of silly question was between you and Nick, when you're flying, who's the pilot and how do you choose?
When we're flying, well, that's we used to take it in turns.
Yeah. Like the kid says, my turn in the front seat.
Yeah, well, it is like that. And then we've had too many accidents, so we don't actually fly together anymore. So we thought with us both being knocked off, it's too terrible for families and business. So no, we haven't really met. We don't fly anymore.
Yeah,
so that makes that answer quite.
I'm sure the insurance company had some say in that one as well.
Yes, there is a little of that.
Brilliant, Giles. How can someone? What's the best way to get in touch with Beaumont or get in touch with you? What's the preferred way to follow you?
Yeah, follow us either me or my the personal Giles English Instagram and Twitter and Bremont at Bremont. And please go and see our stores. Put your name on our database. We have monthly adventure club events where we get these amazing explorers who come and chat and connect with the brand and follow us. And we'd love to see you and love to get feedback as well. So thank you very much for having me on your podcast.
My
really appreciate
pleasure, Giles. Lovely, lovely time. So I hope to come down and see you in Henley sometime. I gather you just signed up to become the official sponsor of the Henley Regatta.
The first official partner they've ever had in 178 years, I think it is.
Good.
So us Hackett and Aston Martin. So we're very pleased with that.
Making waves again, Giles. Congratulations. Thanks very much for being on the show.
Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for having listened to this recording of the Minter Dialogue Show. You'll find the show notes on themindset.com, that's mindset with a Y, where you can also sign up for my weekly newsletter at /subscribe. If you like the show, please do rate it in iTunes, that really makes my day. Happy trails, and enjoy Josh Sachs's Painted Fingers.
Oh, fill me with all your colors any different way. Rid me of the gray and heal me with all your imperfections that you mention in your lack of self-security. Oh, I wouldn't care about the art form as long as you would feel warm wrapped in canvas. Hold me tightly, slowly. with all your favorite shades, and we paint it with our fingers to show the world the way we feel. Oh, oh, the way I feel.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I want to tell you about my podcast called Can I Offer You Some Feedback? I'm a business consultant and executive coach with over 20 years' experience in change management, leadership development, and naturally providing feedback to high performers. My podcast is for those of you who have a complicated relationship with feedback, whether giving, receiving, avoiding, or seeking. Feedback is essential for our development. In each episode, you'll hear from real people across industries with their ideas, perspectives, and best practices on feedback. I'll also be sharing business bites with you, simple explanations of organizational tools, management techniques, and leadership philosophies that will help you and your businesses thrive. You can listen to Can I Offer You Some Feedback on your favorite podcast app or learn more at evergreenpodcasts.com.